My name is Andrew Clay. I'm an attorney for Kenny Morsang. And if I might reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, I appreciate that. Thank you. I believe the important aspects of this case is to make sure that, you know, the court holds both ALJs and the commissioner accountable for following their own regulations and rulings. I gotta admit, when I'm reviewing cases, I'm looking for more medical evidence than in this case typically when I decide to take a case. This is admittedly, there's a lot of gaps and holes in treatment records. Frankly, I think it's my client is just a person who does not go to the doctor unless it's absolutely necessary. As evidenced by, you know, his diagnosis of stage 4 cancer despite coughing up blood and passing out for a couple months before he even seeks treatment. So that is my read of the evidence and why there's gaps in it. But I could not get past the fact that this is a step to denial. We have a minimum threshold here to meet. You know, the words of de minimis screening or groundless claims. The commissioner's own rulings talk about the minimal effects test in step 2. We have a day last observed back in March of 11, but he was the entire time period between his alleged onset date and the day last observed.
I don't have a visual of what a meth ran to be on oxygen, how is he interfering with his ability to perform normal work activities? Is it because he's weighing the oxygen, he's not capable of lifting or walking, or is it the same thing, or is it just like the coerciveness?
I think there's both aspects to it, and that's it. The vocational expert said, look, if you're basically having a log oxygen tank around you all day, that's an accommodation for a disability, which, as we addressed in the briefing, accommodations are not accounted for in assessing whether a person can work. I mean, these are step 5 initiatives.
So, just give me a visual of what it is. Like a big thing that you have to wheel around?
Well, yeah, I gotta admit, I don't know. I wasn't there at the time, obviously, but I have seen oxygen tanks with wheels, and you have a mask.
Yeah.
Dr. Mulligan verified in a letter he was to be on oxygen at all times. This isn't just periodic, boy, I'm out of breath, let's take a
counsel. So it's cool if I can interject here. We'll have a brief answer. Assuming that we were to conclude that the ALJ erred at step 2 and should not have screened this case out by saying it's not severe, procedurally, what happens then? Should we also address before remanding the credibility finding, medical expert issue, or do we just send it back and let that play out?
Well, that's exactly right, Your Honor. That's the next step I was getting to, Your Honor. I don't think I'm a layperson. According to Wikipedia, none of us are here are doctors, okay? Exactly. Medical doctors. I wanted to make sure I was right before I stated that oral argument that no one has an MD in their name, in their names. But it is really not up to us to assess when cancer progresses to stage 4, how quickly it might be, the effects of COPD and the cirrhosis on his stamina, ability to work. That is exactly why, you know, we have these cases with Armstrong and Morgan and DeLorme and Social Security's own ruling 8320 fits this to a T.
Can I suggest that you have not yet answered Judge Cole's question?
Well,
let's say I was thinking, but tell me if I'm wrong, I was thinking that if we were to rule for you on this first issue, that would take care of it, it would go back and we'd be done. But are you saying that we still have more work to do?
Well, I would ask for remand with direction to retain the medical expert to assess the onset date of this disability, because it's clearly got to be inferred by a medical expert. No one knows precisely when the impacts of all these impairments, and I'm not necessarily only talking about step 3, is he meeting the cancer list?
The answer was only for the cancer of the esophagus, wasn't it?
Right, and has not been, and I think colleagues have been clear in my briefing, experts are not only retained for step three, but they can be asked, okay, what functional limitations should be expected for the RFC assessment, which then would apply to step four, step five.
I would discover that I thought you only asked for the one with the medical expert to figure out the onset date, but I thought with respect to disability for the cancer, right?
No, you know, when we talk about meeting more equally, equally means you take everything into the impact. With the impact of the COPD and cirrhosis, limit functioning day to day, and it's for the cancer. And it's not, again, just for the 13.02 assessment, but I've, over my years, asked many of my medical experts at a hearing, well, okay, if he doesn't meet at least use step three, what functioning limitations would be expected based on his record and testimony, and would his testimony be well supported? Again, that would go to Judge Gould's questioning. The medical expert not only looks at the medical evidence, but they're supposed to at least be at the hearing for hearing, and they can even ask questions about, well, did you have this symptom, that symptom? And then we say, medical expert, what function limitations would you expect for what this record supports, not only on the record, but testimony? And therefore, we can assess an RFC. We can even get to that point. And that's why I think it's important, and following the commissioner's own direction in SSR 8327,
we have medical experts. How does the protocol justify the plans of the intervening
Well, I thought my assessment was the credibility finding was rather cursory. She said, well, he claimed he got worse, and the record doesn't support that. That is not what he claimed. He actually said that oxygen for nearly 13 months helped him. He was able to go ozone, albeit, you know, it took him an hour rather than the normal 20 minutes, and he had to take several breaks. But he said it did help him, and then the county yanked it because of funding, or, you know, they didn't prove it anymore. So he did not say, I have worse symptoms. He actually, the COPD was getting better because of the oxygen. So I think the judge mischaracterized his testimony in the credibility finding. The other finding was, you know, mental and sporadic treatment, there's no doubt about that. But if there's a reasonable explanation, and he's from a remote area, he did not have insurance medicine either, and he's just not the type that runs to the doctor every time. So, yes, is that a clear and convincing reason to throw out all of his testimony when we have all these symptoms and documented medical treatment for the COPD, the cirrhosis? He almost expired, according to his doctor, prior to the DOS. Sure, that has to be severe impairment. And we're talking about credibility also, in my mind, within the prison of the step two finding. I mean, he's saying he's not even credible at step two for the mental impact test. I think this credibility finding has errors, and upon a new hearing, you know, we have a full opportunity to develop the testimony and make a fresh credibility finding on all of that. But I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have some time for a little bit? Let's hear from counsel for the government.
Good morning, Your Honor. Shaybond on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security. I'm glad that counsel and the girl on board that benefits their positions. But we did have multiple positions in this case analyze this record and come to the conclusion that although claimant was disabled in 2013 because of the treatment, the kind of toxicity of the treatment, the chemotherapy and the radiation, disabled him according to our listings, that he did not have a disability going back to the insured period. So we did have two experts look at this record, and they looked at the record in the middle of 2013, so all of a sudden that's clearly in the record before the ALJ.
Counsel, Judge Moore, if I can interject, I'm going to get you out of the stream of your argument, but I really am having trouble given the standard we have at step two that follows de minimis to screen out phony claims with saying that someone has to lug an oxygen tank around with them doesn't have a severe impairment. It just seems it's more rational if the ALJ had viewed that as a severe impairment and then proceeded to assess the person's RFC and what they could do, their best work or some other work, but to not even analyze it seems to me very strange.
I'm going to disagree that the ALJ did not analyze the oxygen intake. That was analyzed in the decision. The ALJ acknowledged that the claimant had a oxygen services provided by the county. The ALJ found that there was...
Counsel, I didn't see that the ALJ didn't even mention the oxygen intake, but did the ALJ just craft an RFC?
Well, no, because the ALJ found that the claimant did not have, and this is consistent with what the two state agency doctors had concluded, but that there was insufficient evidence showing that there was a severe impairment dating back to the insured period. And so when the ALJ was talking, acknowledged the state agency doctor's opinions, also talked about the allegations regarding using oxygen, and found that it was essentially not medically necessary based on his record and the claimant's testimony, because the claimant had testified that he was actually functional without the oxygen. I would also point out that there is nothing within the contemporaneous treatment records, and this is from Dr. Mulligan at the Department of Indian Health, when the claimant did go in and seek some sporadic treatment, it is never noted that he had an exertion or a medical need for oxygen. And so I think it's very important because although the claimant, when he was discharged from the emergency room, was instructed to use the oxygen, I do not believe that that was a prescription that was supposed to be ongoing forever without continuation. So when the claimant went into his primary provider, Dr. Mulligan, the list of current medications, and also the way the treatment record describes it, it's supplies as well. Administrative Record 368. It says active outpatient medications, including supplies, medical supplies. There's no mention of oxygen in that list. There's a list of 12 or 13 different medications. There is no option that he had oxygen.
Well, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that the claimant's medical cover is his testimony and his representations.
Correct.
And you add all that. This record actually shows that the ALJ made a clear enough finding and referred specifically to his testimony that he contradicted the record otherwise, but the words that what was sufficient credibility to find was laid out by the ALJ in this record.
I do, and I think the ALJ is talking about credibility, and particularly if we're focusing on the oxygen, it's on page 19 of the administrative record. So the ALJ is talking about, again, acknowledges that there's an oxygen service provided, but then specifically points out that the claimant had made some exaggerated allegations about once the oxygen was removed, he dizzy, couldn't breathe, passed out, fell flat on his head. And so the ALJ specifically discounted that portion of the claimant's testimony, saying that there's no objective evidence from the doctor verifying that information. He never complained about that to anyone. He never requested that the oxygen services be restarted once it was taken away. And he never asked for a doctor to continue the services. So
he didn't ask for it to be restarted. He didn't ask for it to be restarted once it was taken away because he could not afford to pay for it, and the agency that he was paying for it said, we're not going to pay for it anymore. So
I don't see any allegation in this record that the claimant was unable to afford treatment. There's never been an allegation.
He's seeking these benefits because he's got a foundation on the side. As long as he's actually still buying it.
That's a different question.
I think it's a surge. Also, you know he could not afford it.
Your Honor, I'm going to disagree. There's a question between disability benefits and having insurance or means to obtain treatment, and there's been no allegation that the claimant was unable to obtain treatment except for.
He was uninsured.
The one allegation that I could find in the record was in the end of 2012. There was a question about whether he could get the referral to a specialist. And that was the only time he was on county medical services. There was no allegation that he made to the ALJ that he could not afford.
Does it cost per month to have a 24-hour oxygen?
I don't know, Your Honor.
I have no idea whether he in fact could afford
complaining about his financial situation. You're not in a position to tell us that he...
And there's no access.
There are continuation because he was able to afford it. He just didn't want it, right?
There's not an inspector that he's alleging that he couldn't afford it. That's not part of it. That would be us making grand speculations about his ability to afford treatment, which has not been an allegation in this case.
That's not all the problem I have here. I know you said that the record shows, but it appears to me that the AJ generalizes, speaking about how there's inconsistency between the claimant's representations and the claimant's
testimony. It's just that there's nothing when you look at the treatment records that talk about that he was using the oxygen tank when he showed up to his appointments. He did not have a big comment to get it with it. The talk tank with him, his objective findings, he was going to be in no acute distress every time he showed up to see Dr. Mulligan. His long foods were clear. He said that medication actually helped his COPD and he was stable in all of his conditions. This is not just a picture of someone who was actually using an oxygen tank to the extent that he alleged or that he required it. And when Dr. Mulligan issued two letters in 2013 and again in 2014, Dr. Mulligan didn't mention that he had any limitations for any of his impairments except in the current present tense. So when the plaintiff's attorney was talking to the ALJ at the hearing, he actually said, you know, our theory of our case is that the claimant's impairments and disabilities reach back into the insured period. And the ALJ asked him, do you have any medical opinions to support that? And he said, well, we have the opinion from Dr. Mulligan, which talks about disability in the present tense. And the agency agrees that the claimant became disabled from cancer in 2013. But the claimant's treating doctor was not willing to offer a retrospective opinion to see that the claimant had any limitations that would impact what we would consider to be basic work activities. The evidence is absent.
I see the same question Judge Gould posed to you. One, if we disagree with you on this first issue, do you agree with your opponent that the agency reached the second and third issues?
If you find that the ALJ should have found a severe impairment dating back to step two, then I would say at that point, then you would remand it back for an evaluation because that would be the difference in the legal case.
Do we still need to resolve at least the medical expert issues?
Oh, I don't believe this case requires a medical expert. The only time you need a medical expert is if you need to refer an onset date. And I don't think you need to refer an onset date.
Dr. Wofford was asking you if we have to decide that, not to make an argument on the merits of it, but if we say that the step two decision was incorrect, should we decide the medical expert issue one way or the other?
I don't think you have to. I think you can send this back to the ALJ for if you conclude that there was a affirmative error here, it would be back to the ALJ for an assessment. But I would point out that we already had two expert physicians review this record and conclude that there was two basis for finding severe impairment during that time. So we already have that evidence in the record. To have another opinion to look at this would just be, I guess, repetitious at this point.
Well, counsel, the rule says if I don't want to beat a dead horse in a sense, if I know the government's committed on its position, but if you have a person who's got a form of cancer in the larynx and has a problem with their liver, so they have liver cirrhosis, and they have a problem with their lungs of COPD, what would it do to our precedent about step two if we were to say in those circumstances there's not a severe impairment here because he can get by it and all the things you're saying?
Well, I think the circuit's precedent also states that a mere diagnosis of an impairment is not indicative of the severity of the impairment. There has to be evidence of concurrent limitations stemming from that impairment that impact basic work activities. That precedent already exists. And here I would submit that although the claimant had cancer, it wasn't the diagnosis that disabled him. It was the fact that he was undergoing this rather costly treatment. And during the sort of period, as it relates, say, to the throat issues, the only complaint that the claimant had was that his voice was hoarse, and that doesn't impact basic work activities. He had one instance where he was hospitalized for an acute buildup of fluid in his abdomen from his liver. He was treated and released for that, and his condition was described as stable, and it actually improved thereafter. And again, with the COPD, his examinations during the injury period were normal. There was an X-ray of his lungs, which showed normal lung structures. There were other presence of COPD there, and his medication improved his lung function. That's the objective evidence that we have here. So although diagnoses exist, you still have to declare it's responsible for clearing up limitations following from those impairments, and that's what's absent from this record. To show severity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
While addressing counsel's assertion that there's two experts that have already reviewed the case, that was at the early level review, non-examining doctors, and they both, if you look at my excerpts of the record between pages 61 and 72, only are focusing on the cancer diagnosis. And as I say, he had already been found disabled at that time. For the SSI portion, but they said there's not cancer, evidence of cancer prior to diagnostic service, and therefore not severe. If you find a step two error, step two finding is error, you know, by necessity you have to discount their opinions on that basis, that their opinions were not supported either. That does lead into the directives of SSR 8320. That fits this to a T. The commissioner adopted these own rulings. If we've already been found disabled and we have to go back and see how far back it goes, a medical expert is required under the Ninth Circuit in 8320. I'm just asking the court to hold the commissioner to follow her own rulings here. That's exactly what the SSR 8320 is for, this precise case. So I would ask that a medical expert, preferably, perhaps, I don't know, an oncologist or some type of person, because there is a warning agent diagnosed in this esophagus in September 2010. In retrospect, it's stage 4 cancer by January of 13. Perhaps a medical expert could get some insight into that, along with, you know, additional information from the client and their testimony to assess, was that an important factor to diagnostic service. The counsel also referred to him being released from the hospital. He was released from the hospital with directives to use oxygen at all times. Upon that release, he did that for 13 months. Dr. Malkin verified that he did use it at all times. He did improve, but not enough to say that there's a step two